Hi, this is John Stark for TGCReviews.com, the book review site of thegospelcoalition.org. On July 22, 2010, I had the opportunity to speak with Andrew Nocelli, author of the new book, Let Go and Let God, a survey and analysis of Keswick theology, published through Logos in the fall of 2010. All right, Andy, if you could maybe get us oriented with Keswick theology, many of us have heard of it, but wouldn't be able to articulate the substance of it. Can you help us with that just a little bit?
Sure. Let me first explain why it's called Keswick theology, where it came from, and then I'll define the term.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Keswick. It's spelled K-E-S-W-I-C. So some people pronounce it Keswick because they don't know the W silent. It's Keswick, and that's a small town in the Lake District of England. And in 1875, a conference happened there, and it's happened every July since. And it's still going on today. In fact, today, this week, the guy I work for, Don Carson, is one of the speakers at the Keswick Convention. So it's been going on since 1875, and it hosts these week-long meetings where people come together to have a conference about the Bible. And it's evangelicals, but what distinguishes them from other evangelicals is that they believe that there are two categories of Christians. They're the level one and level two Christians. First you get saved, then you get serious. First you live a defeated Christian life, then you live a victorious Christian life. Mm-hmm. So the aim of the conference is to help those Christians who are at level one to go to level two. So when I talk about Keswick theology, I'm talking about that. It's that theology that characterized the Keswick conferences of its first generation from about 1875 to about 1920. So today, the Keswick Convention is nothing like it was back then. People today will hold what's called a reformed view of sanctification. Back then, they would not hold that.
Hmm. And who would be sort of your prominent figures over the years?
Well, with just Keswick, I mean, Keswick's related to history. I mean, it's connected to some forerunners that would include people like John Wesley and Robert and Hannah Purcell Smith, those people. But the Keswick itself has some names that people would recognize today, like H.C.G. Moule, probably Keswick's best theologian, F.B. Meyer, a lot of devotional books still in print, Andrew Murray, probably Keswick's foremost devotional author, like a couple hundred, many of them still in print. Some missionaries like Hudson Taylor and Amy Carmichael, a hymnist named Francis Havergal, A.T. Pearson, W.H. Griffith Thomas, Charles Trumbull, Robert McQuilkin. These are some names associated with that first generation of Keswick theology.
So can you help us understand how Keswick theology today looks different than it did at its beginnings?
Yeah. At the beginning, they held to what I'm calling Keswick theology, but they started transitioning gradually to a more reformed view of sanctification that would not see Christians as either in category one or category two. That is, you can look at Christians and have a category of carnal Christians and a category of those who are living the spirit-filled, victorious Christian life, where it's a distinct difference between the two. And that started in the 1920s with William Graham Scroggie all the way through the 50s, and just went more and more when they had people like John Stott come in and preach. And today they'll have people like Sinclair Ferguson and Don Carson, which just shows how far they've come.
Hmm. Are there any particular institutions that have developed out of the Keswick movement?
Well, there's not a single seminary or college that is like the seedbed of Keswick theology, but Keswick theology has influenced some very influential schools like Moody Bible Institute, Dallas Theological Seminary, and a host of Bible schools that are smaller Bible schools, a whole denominations like Christian Missionary Alliance at its roots, and people called Pentecostals as well.
Now, what prompted enough interest for you in Keswick theology and the movement as a whole to accomplish a project like this?
Yeah, it's a really personal story, actually, because I grew up in some churches where this was the assumed theology. So I would hear it preached, and it would be kind of like this, and it's all good intentions. Basically, the preacher would, appeal to my struggle with sin and my desire, my holy desire to be victorious over that struggle. And the method is where the false step occurs. It's viewing Christians in two different categories and then providing a 1, 2, 3, do this, and then you'll go from category one to category two. And what that looked like in my experience was usually an appeal at the end of the sermon to come forward and make some kind of commitment or dedication or rededication, accompanied by, you know, writing down somewhere, this is the date when I, you know, dedicated my life to Christ, or when I, whatever you call it. It's very distinct, such that the rest of your life, when you give your Christian testimony, you talk about the day you became a Christian, and then this day, the day you got serious, whatever you call that. And I struggle with that because I had that experience, and then a little later in life, I was kind of frustrated and disillusioned with the experience because I was still struggling with sins. And I would repeat the process over and over and over and beat myself up. And I just realized there's something wrong about this. Not only does it not work, I don't see scriptural grounding for this paradigm. So I started looking and digging. And it's hard to dig when the people around you, your spiritual leaders and many of your friends, are assuming that that whole paradigm is the right one. It's hard to get more information from a different viewpoint. So that was part of the struggle, and part of the reason for writing this book is I digged and digged and digged and learned more and more, and I think the Lord opened my eyes to what His Word says about this, and I learned a lot about history, where it all came from. So I'm trying to really expose the roots of this historically, it's false theologically, and really serve people who are stuck in the mire of this paradigm of Christian living.
So you would say that there's still the substance of Keswick theology in sort of the greater popular evangelical church today?
Yeah, I'm not a demographic expert who can list off all these sociological stats, but in my limited experience and talking to my network of friends and people, whatever, I found it to be still very prevalent today.
Now, when you're going through this research and you're working on your project, were there many other works that summarized Keswick's history and its movement and its theology?
Well, yeah, I looked at every single one of them and read them and summarized them and learned from them. But I couldn't find a single source that actually goes through the history of the movement, explains its theology, critiques its theology, kind of holistically just explains the thing, and then analyzes it and has an extensive bibliography where you can find more. I really had to dig and dig and dig to do this. So I'm not aware of another book like it.
Now, you maintain that Keswick theology is orthodox, so there's no problem with heresy or an orthodoxy. But one of your critiques is that it emphasizes holiness and disproportionately de-emphasizes theology. Can you talk a little bit about how that has shown itself to be a problem throughout its history?
Okay, first, when I say it's orthodox, I mean that it's not heresy in the sense that you can believe Keswick theology and still be a Christian.
Right.
It's not one of these beliefs that is damning. It's nowhere near that kind of category of error. Basically, I read just about everything I could find on Keswick theology, including the primary sources. And as I would read them, what I learned is that there was a big emphasis on experience. There was a corresponding lack of good exegesis. And what would happen is that when people, Keswick proponents would try to propagate the message, they would have these asides about, you know, we don't want to get into divisive doctrines. They're just more of an experiential emphasis and not a careful dealing with doctrine where you thoughtfully work through a doctrine. And part of the reason for that is it's ecumenical in the sense that it transcends denominations. So anytime you group together more than one denomination, there's going to be some sort of doctrinal compromise, and that's sometimes it's a good thing. Like the Gospel Coalition, it's deliberately focusing on the gospel. It doesn't mean that the differences are insignificant, but it's saying we're focused on this main thing. Well, they're focusing on a main thing, and I'm just saying the main thing they're focusing on is fundamentally flawed. It's very experiential. And as a result, they're actually minimizing doctrines that are very important. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You pointed out they overlooked certain figures like Hannah Whittle Smith's universalism.
Yes, yes. And that's, anyone can be guilty of doing that where you're so convinced your view's right, and maybe there's someone who espouses your view and they're really good at espousing that view. They've got a charismatic personality and you really want them on your team, and yet they believe some other things that really would disqualify them from being able to minister with you. But, you know, they're so charismatic and they're so gifted and oh, I really want them, and it caused them to make, I think, some pretty bad judgment calls on who they'd let speak.
Yeah. One of your,
or who they recommend.
Yeah. One of your concerns that were more pastoral, I thought, was the haves and the have-nots in Keswick mm-hmm. theology. Maybe you can just explain what you mean by haves and have-nots and then maybe summarize your
concern. Yeah, well, the haves and the have-nots refer to the people who have experienced that second something to get them to level two, whether it's the spirit filling or the second blessing or all kinds of ways to describe it. But the people who have experienced that, I would say, are the haves, and the people who haven't are the have-nots. And the people who have experienced it, I wouldn't say this of all of them, but there's the tendency towards elitism and being proud and divisive about their experience and looking down on those who haven't had it. And then for the have-nots, that's where I was. You get disillusioned and frustrated because it doesn't seem to work, and you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and you try to, you know, get victorious and you consecrate yourself and it doesn't work and you repeat it and you're just it beats you up. So I give the example of J.I. Packer. Mm-hmm. He had very much experienced this when he embraced, well, he was taught Keswick theology with the Christians he was around, and then he discovered the Puritans, and that was his way out into the truth. But it took a while to get there.
Yeah.
And in the process, he got beat up really badly.
Now, this is probably the most, I don't know, acclaimed ebook I've ever seen. And you've made a small apologetic for keeping this an ebook. And you just want to explain what this book is, its format through Logos, and maybe when it's coming out and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I've been asked this question over and over and over. Will your book be available in print?
Yeah.
And it's a complicated answer. The short answer is no, at least for now. It's available through Logos Bible Software. Logos.com, Logos.com is where it's available right now for pre-order. Should come out later this year through the Logos platform. And, you know, I did approach some print publishers about it, and a lot of them thought that it wouldn't sell well enough to even take on. One publisher said they'd take it if I paid them like $3,000 to cover printing costs and such things. And I worked through that and some other issues. I thought, you know, Logos has a pretty sweet deal. I love Logos. I'd rather have a book in Logos format than in any other format, including print, any day. Hmm. I've got like a 4,000 book Logos library on my computer. So I just am a huge fan of Logos. I think that using electronic books and Logos Bible software is more efficient than print books because you can search them so easily. It's so versatile. Use it on an iPhone. You can use it on an iPad or other smartphone. You can use it on any computer, sync across them, highlight, change font size, link resources, hyperlink resources. Really cool. And the platform itself is free, so it's not like you have to invest a whole bunch of money in Logos. You could just get the free platform, though I'd recommend Logos for other things. It's available. It's not one of these programs that's available just for Mac or just for PC. It's for both. Right. In fact, today, Logos beta for Mac just came out, so it's really progressing. And then for the people who have to have it in print, and you could print it off, and printing's pretty cheap, and better support just came out for printing. So I can go on and on about why I chose Logos. I don't need to make an apologetic here, but yes, it's available only electronically at this point.
Good. Well, I wanted to highlight a few things that we didn't get to cover in our little interview here. The appendixes, I thought, were especially helpful, and I hope people don't look over them. You have five views of sanctification. One of them is an appendix on five views of sanctification. where you compare Keswick view with the Wesleyan view and the Reform view and others. That was helpful. You put a few word studies together that are pertinent to this discussion and a great bibliography for further study. So those are helpful. The appendix to this are more helpful than I've found in other books. And finally, I just thought, honestly, Andy, I thought this was just a great book on sanctification. Someone may see the book and just think, well, I'm not interested in Keswick theology. But in many ways, the Keswick movement acts as, well, I don't know if you actually purposely did this, but it acts as a foil, having to respond to something to really be able to clarify an issue, and this being sanctification. So it really acts as a great book on sanctification and clarifying a lot. And your parallel life with J.F. Packer is amazing. So this is a great, great book on sanctification. So I'm very thankful for that.
Thank you. And that's really the story of the history of the church, isn't it? Where there's an error that crops up, and the church responds, and as a result, the church has a increased understanding of that particular doctrinal area. And, you know, I'm not saying that mine's anywhere on par with that in history, but of course it's not. But like the doctrine of the Trinity and of the nature of Christ, the nature of salvation, these things are all responses to gross error. Now, the error I'm responding to isn't that gross. It's not that huge. I think it's really important. It's a big deal, but it's not heresy like those others. But the point I'm making is that when you respond to something that's not quite right, it forces you to clarify what is right in a way that is much more edifying than otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Andy, I'm grateful for your time, and I'm grateful for the book, and I wish you the best for it.
Thanks for the opportunity. I'm honored. Thank you for having me.
All right, Andy. Thanks for listening. This has been John Stark with TGCReviews.com, the book review site of thegospelcoalition.org.